everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable, episode number 131. Today we're discussing The Legend of Korra, book 4, episode 5, Enemy at the Gates, and chapter 6, The Battle of Zaufu. My name is Michal, I'll be your host for today. I'm joined by superfans Caitlin and Mitch, and our newbie Karen. And if you would like to contact us about stuff, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a comment on this post on hypeable.com, or you can play with us on Tumblr, specifically with Brittany on Tumblr, at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So, fun fact, my fun fact for today is that immediately to my right, I have a caramel latte. Caitlin, how about you?
My fun fact is that immediately to my right, I have papers that I need to grade.
That's like more like a sad fact.
Yeah, well, quote unquote fun.
It's okay. I was going to go with a really depressing one, and then the latte arrives. Karen, how about you?
Well, I don't want to break tradition. So immediately to my right, I have a proto for a Nebula Dorbs that I won on Facebook. So that's exciting.
Is that in English? I don't think I understood that.
It's a prototype. It's what they use to make all the Dorbs. They're like...
What? They're really make what?
D-O-R-B-Z. Dorbs.
I don't know what that is.
Google it. They're really cute. And this one's for Nebula from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Is that like
I don't know if they're associated with Funko. I think they're associated with Funko because I'm pretty sure I won it from the Funko page. So they're like a little figurine thing.
Awesome. Well, Mitch is having technical difficulties, so we'll get back to his fun fact later in the podcast. Stay tuned. But for now, let's get into our synopsis of Enemy at the Gates. In this chapter, Kuvira is still crazy bonkers. She wants to take over the metal city of metal-bending hipsters, but Seiyun is like, no way, Jose. So Korra has to intervene because she's new and fresh and peaceful now. But it doesn't matter anyway because Lin was right, guys, and Sue does what Sue wants, and Sue, what, who cares? Also, Julie betrays Varric, but whatever, we know this is a lie, true love, like Iron Man. In this episode, we have these are definitely two episodes that work very well together. We have the airbending kids bringing Korra back to Zaufu, where we have a lot of conflict going on. Karen, how did you feel about kind of the escalating situation in Zaufu with Kuvira outside?
It was really intense for a different reason, because obviously we don't get the fighting until the very end of the second episode, really. But it was a lot of, like, political steps being made where, you know, we're not going to give up. Well, I'm not going to go away. And if you just do this, then we can have peace. And it's like, I mean, I don't like Kuvira and I don't trust her and I don't think she's doing the right thing. Although I think she thinks she's doing the right thing, as the villains normally do. But I thought it was really interesting that she was willing to kind of give and take a little bit, even though I think she was using that even as manipulation. So it was really interesting just to see how she was handling talking to Sue and then the Avatar and Bolin and all of that. It was crazy.
Yeah, definitely. Caitlin, how did you think that this was going to go down? Did you find a little more depth in it this time? I know when I was rewatching it, I was definitely impressed at how many kind of political and psychological layers were going on here.
I think what kind of stuck out to me was kind of what Karen was saying, that Kuvira is how manipulative she was. Like, she was using her... It seemed very clear she was pretending to give something to the other side, but it was obviously, like, two steps ahead. She knew she would get what she wanted out of it. So seeing kind of her being so manipulative was interesting, because we know how strong she is as a character, but seeing that intelligence come out is really intriguing too.
Yeah, for sure. And she's definitely firing on all cylinders in these episodes. Something a little surprising that happens is that Varric kind of comes to the realization that the work he's doing for Kuvira and Batar is not good guy work, and he starts to actually care about that, which was, I don't know, sort of a rapid turn, but also maybe something that was coming from a guy who continually... Varric has been, like, he's really funny, but he's a little one-note. So he kind of does a turn in this episode toward the... I mean, I guess if we want to use Ariana's metaphor of Iron Man, he kind of has the, like, post-war post-kidnapping Iron Man experience of like, oh, I should not be doing this war stuff anymore. That's bad. And then Pepper Potts betrays him. So, Karen, how did you feel about Varric's development here?
I mean, Pepper Potts would never betray Tony Stark, but that's beside the
I
point.
I think she should sometimes, be completely honest with you. That's a different story.
It is a different story.
Literally.
I thought this was really interesting. I mean, I definitely have always seen Varric as a type of Howard Stark, but in this instance, he definitely did a Tony Stark when he was like, yeah, the whole war profiteering thing, maybe not such a good guy move. So he decided to, he developed a conscience, which was apparently very confusing for him. But I thought it was funny, and I thought that was kind of Varric's way of doing the right thing, even though he's just really out there sometimes. But I enjoyed it because I've liked Varric from the beginning, and I never wanted him to be a bad guy. I always thought he was just kind of misguided and sort of this crazy genius, and not that that's necessarily an excuse, but I wanted him to kind of come to terms with what he's done in the past and maybe try to turn over a new leaf, and he's starting to do that, and he was being pretty altruistic about it, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, he was, and the person who wasn't being altruistic in a change in circumstances was Yulee, so Caitlin, you know a little more about how this works out, but how did you feel about Julie's betrayal? I found it personally extremely satisfying.
I mean, anything where she finally gets to tell him off, I am just like, applause, applause.
Yeah.
Because he needs it, and she has probably been bottling up a lot of frustration with him for years, so that was enjoyable.
Yeah. And Karen, do you buy it? Do you think she has gone over to Kuvira's side?
No. See, I'm of two minds with this, because on the one side, like, he's horrible to her, and I definitely want her to stand up for herself, and I hope that with this situation, he appreciates her more. But at the same time, like, I really like that she's so loyal to him, and I think that Kuvira is not a good person to follow, and I hope she's being, like, a double agent right now, and that she's doing the thing. And she's just going to come back and be like, I did the thing. And then he's going to be happy. But also he needs to change his tune because he is horrible to her.
And yes, I have to jump in here. I'm back. I'm not dead. Just to say, hi, it's Mitch, in case anyone doesn't know. I love when Julie finally gets like a character here. And it's kind of part of my favorite moments in these episodes. But it's amazing to see like she goes from being, you know, just this do this thing lady to like someone that actually matters and can make a change. I think that's pretty cool that she just does what she does here. I mean, yeah, it may not be the best because it's like you're joining up with Kavir's forces, but at least you're doing something.
And I personally really feel for her, you know, like Varric saves her from the thing and he's just being nasty the whole time. And yeah. So something else that is going on in this episode, we have a small Asami plot, which is kind of the first time we've seen her on her own. She basically goes to visit her father in prison. Hiroshi is still around, lost a lot of weight, got a lot of gray hair. And he has been sending her letters, kind of trying to apologize and reopen their connection. And Asami is not interested initially, but then she kind of, you know, has some time sitting by herself and sort of comes to a realization that there may not be a way for them to reconnect, but it might be worth trying. So, Mitch, how did you feel about this?
You know, it's interesting because I could feel for Asami in a way that you don't want to let go of everyone in your past. Like, say you, like, lost a best friend and that you don't want to have to, like, you know, rid them forever. But to a point where you're just like, I need my own peace. I need to like tell them that I don't want them anymore. And I love, I can't remember if it's in this episode or the next where she actually like plays Pai Show with her father. Regardless though, when she gets to that point, it's like, I get it. Like, be careful, Asami, but I get it why you let him back in. And it's, I mean, that's pretty heartbreaking to have your own father be someone that you have to do that to. I couldn't imagine having to do that to like a family member. That's pretty intense.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it's, you know, it's a very moving scene. I'm not sure if I were in Asami's position, I would do the same thing, but I understand why she does what she does. Karen or Caitlin, any thoughts on Asami? Definitely seeing a different side of her in this episode.
I mean, I'm not sure I'm convinced she's letting him back in. She's giving him the opportunity to earn his way back in. But she's not being like, okay, everything's okay now that we're playing Paisho. She's saying, okay, you're my father. Here's an opportunity for you to earn a way back into my life, I feel like. So I feel like there's a distinction there.
Yeah, for sure. And if it had been, you know, her just like letting him off the hook, I think I would have had a lot of problems with this plotline. But they definitely walk an interesting line and don't do that.
And what an interesting way to come back into her life. That was the perfect line to say. It wasn't to really apologize for anything. It was more of just to say, like, I mean, to take from Ariana's words, that Asami's basically a perfect Victoria's Secret model and astronaut, and also the most accommodating friend slash girlfriend to ever exist. And I have to say, if I was a father, I'd be pretty proud of that too, especially the astronaut part.
That's the third series of Avatar. Astronaut.
Asami the astronaut, the legend of Asami.
Right.
I'd watch it.
That'd be amazing. Could you imagine, for real? Like, that's what needs to happen now.
Well, Yui is the moon.
Oh, that'd be so fun. She can go explore her face.
Maybe they'd be called, like, Yue Knots or something.
Yue Knots, that's beautiful. Oh, gosh.
We also spend, obviously, a lot of time in Xiaofu in this episode, because this is where all the drama is kind of converging. And, yeah, Su Beifong has some very specific ideas about how things should happen. Understandably, she's not really pleased that her city is being invaded. But we also get kind of the official backstory of what happened between her and Kuvira, which is that, you know, Su was actually asked to become Kuvira, basically, to assume control of the Earth Kingdom in the interim while everything was going insane, and Kuvira was like, yeah, you should do that. People need help. And Su, rightly maybe, decided not to because it was too much power and she didn't feel it was her place. However, Kuvira saw that as abandoning the people of the Earth Kingdom who needed help. So she basically up and left and took most of Xiaofu with her, or at least their military strength, to go do what Su was not prepared to. Yeah, Caitlin, how did you feel about this?
I mean, the fact that Su didn't want the power is, to me, the indication that she should have taken it, because the person who doesn't want it is probably going to do a better job than the person like Kuvira who wants it and is going out of their way to get it. So we probably would have avoided a lot of drama if she had gone with it, because she would have actually been willing to step aside when it was time. So I think Su should have done it, though I understand why she didn't, but she could have stepped aside.
Yeah, and Karen, how do you feel about Kuvira's reaction? To me, I mean, I am a fan of Kuvira, so I do see this kind of sympathetically, and I believe that she wants to help the Earth Kingdom, and that this has become extremely twisted. But how did you see it as kind of altruistic, or was she kind of taking an opportunity to seize power?
I mean, I definitely think she thinks she's doing the right thing. I think she sees Su as someone who's being weak when they need a strong leader. And so she feels as though she's the right person for that job. And she's going to step up no matter what it takes. I think she cares very much about her people. And even though she's going about it the wrong way, I believe, it doesn't necessarily mean that she's evil. I think that she's definitely an antagonist right now, and it's too bad that it's kind of come to what it is, but I don't see her as somebody who necessarily wants control for the sake of just being in power. I think she wants control because she feels like she's the best person to get the Earth Kingdom back on track.
Well, isn't it weird, too, that basically Sue's whole argument is that I just don't want to spread my ideals. And part of me is like, okay, do you just not believe in world leaders ever? Is that why you really, really don't like this idea that Kuvira is taking over? Or what? I mean, I almost side with Kuvira so often. It's a good show of a good villain as in a good presentation. And I'm not sure that I'm with Su. I mean, I get that she doesn't want to give over Xiaofu, but maybe her and Kuvira can come to that agreement. Like, we won't be part of the Earth Empire. I'm going to keep my Xiaofu. You do whatever else you want. We're going to let you have your thing. I think that would have been, I think, like, the best solution to this, because whatever. Su just doesn't want to be involved in world affairs, apparently. That just seems to be her thing.
But I don't think Sue would stand by and let Kuvira continue to do everything she's done either. I mean, she definitely, like, ideologically is opposed to everything Kuvira is doing with the rest of the Earth Kingdom.
Yeah, she's kind of willing to fight evil, but not to prevent it or, like, bad things happening. I don't really like Sue's view. It seems a little disingenuous to me, seeing as she created a city and is the leader of that city and is the boss. You know, she is in charge of Zhaofu. And, you know, I mean, not that that means that she should have taken over, you know, the Earth Kingdom, but her reasons fall a little flat to me, to be completely honest. And the thing is, with Sue, it's like, if she makes a decision, then everybody else has to make that same decision, or they're wrong. And obviously, again, it's you know, kind of extreme, but because she's almost more angry that Kuvira, like, went against her than that Kuvira is taking over the Earth Kingdom, if you know what I mean.
I think that makes a little bit of sense, just considering she considered her a daughter. Like, she felt very close to her. I mean, she must feel betrayed right now.
Yeah, we don't know how mutual that feeling was, though.
True. Well, it seems to be pretty mutual from the fact that Sue says this caused the rift between us. Other than that, they seem to be pretty arm in arm. But, you know, that's just Sue's perspective. There could have been something stewing inside of Kuvira for a while, because we can even think back to in the book 3 finale episodes when Kuvira wants to come along to join the final fight against the Red Lotus. And Sue's like, no, stay here and take care of the injured. Like, it's almost... I mean, I can't help but think of it as almost like a master and a puppy dog kind of relationship they had for a while. Like, yes, master, I'll listen. And then eventually, like, you know, the dog bit back.
Well, and Kuvira goes off with one of Sue's sons and is engaged to him. So that's sort of like a double smack in the face.
Yeah, the funny thing is Kuvira takes away Sue's control, which she does very emphatically in these episodes, when the whole reason that this rift started was presumably because Sue didn't want control. And then all of her control is actually taken away, and she doesn't like that so much.
Right, but I mean, saying all that we are about Sue, would we be even happy if Sue decided to take over the Earth Kingdom? Like,
no,
not even
I don't think she's
just
right
for this
it.
3-year period, or yeah. Because, I mean, think about it. We have a choice of Wu, Sue, arguably Lin, and Kuvira. So, I mean, take your pick.
Yeah. There's got to be someone else. I mean, I understand why Sue has experience leading. I get the idea, but...
I mean, Toph is off in the swamp, so...
Yeah. Toph would be terrible on that.
I just don't get why we didn't see a conversation that Tenzin and Raiko were having with Lin. Maybe... like, Lin just was already like, don't even come to me. I do not want to be this leader. Because if they're for the same reasons of, you know, basically, you know, Lin's run Republic City for a while, too. Her and Tenzin have kind of done that together. And it's funny that she wasn't the first pick that Sue was. I think that Sue doesn't make as much sense, because Lin seems a more aggressive person that would want to actually take this power. I could see Lin actually taking this if they came to her first, personally.
See, that's what scares me, because she's so militaristic. Like, I don't think that would necessarily be the right thing for the Earth Kingdom. I think out of those four choices, Sue makes the most sense, but I really respect her being like, no, I don't think I'm right for this. I don't really want it. Find somebody else. Because some people would just be like, well, you know, okay, I'll be in charge of all of this. Maybe I'm not the right person, but... I'll do it anyway, or they're guilted into it or something. And I think it took a lot of strength for her to be like, no, this is not a good idea. Of course, didn't really end up going too well afterwards, but, you know, those things happen.
I mean, I think the story is representative of damned if you do, damned if you don't. It's basically Sue choosing the lesser of two poisons, because there's no way that she can win here. She's put into a very tough position. And I can't help but say, I mean, Sue, you did this to yourself. You created this city. You wanted to be a leader of it. What did you expect but more power to be handed to you? That's just going to happen.
Not only did she create the city, she created Kuvira. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you guys have been saying, and I think that you know, good intentions turning out bad has been a theme of this entire show. So I think it definitely fits the way things have been going. Any other last thoughts on this episode before we move on to favorite scenes and lines?
Bolin needs to not go here anymore.
Yeah, no, Bolin, you're not helping. You are so not helping. And Batar is like,
Adiana wrote, she wrote, speaking of Opal, thank you for telling Bolin off for being a fuckboy.
I don't think he's that bad, but he's in the unenviable position of finding out that the cause that he dedicated his last several years to and that he truly believed in is really not good. And as I said, unenviable. Also, shout out to the photograph, because that's cool. Or the family portrait, because that was awesome.
I don't remember the family portrait. What was it? I thought they were just standing there in real life.
Well, according to Ariana, the Beifongs are Bei in their family portrait.
I think she means when Cora walks in the room and they're all standing there.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. Because they're a really cool group. And I'm a fan of that Beifong group. I'm really happy that Toph did that. It's just... I love strong connections to Atla to say, like, that stuff mattered, and here it is.
What, the Toph had children?
Well, not just that, but the fact that she was such a strong bender, the Blind Bandit. She taught the world metal bending, and, you know, this whole family is almost like, I guess, the legacy of that to me. And that's why I'm so proud of Toph for, like, being as strong-willed as she is and figuring out what she did to get out of that prison cell. Like, that moment still matters, and that makes me happy. That's why I love the Beifongs. They're survivors.
Well, we'll see.
What is that supposed to mean?
Nothing. Mitch, what's your favorite scene from this episode?
Okay. I'm like Cora, because I almost understand Kavira's stance on things when Cora's just like, oh, I guess maybe we should just have a little peaceful thing and maybe, I don't know, Sue should just give over the city. And I was like, yeah. I mean, actually, Cora's so understanding about it, too. She's grown up so much to where she's like, you know, no, Mila, I can't just attack her because she, like, saved my father and all that. And it's amazing that Cora's come as far as she has. I there's no Cora hate here. We'll talk about that. I think we decided in the next episode, right, when that group's on. But, I mean, I'm really loving Cora in book four, and I'm so proud of her for her negotiation skills here because she tries so hard to really, like, calm it all down.
That's interesting, Mitch, because I see her completely the opposite. I think she's being naive in that negotiations. Because
I think
Kuvir is completely manipulating her to get what she wants.
I think she definitely is, but I understand why that is her initial interpretation of the situation. She is being naive, absolutely, but she also doesn't have quite all the information that everyone else does. Like these mysterious camps that we've been hearing of and all that lovely.
I like how Kavira takes advantage of that too. When she first meets someone that she hasn't seen in a while, like, I don't know. Wasn't she really nice to Sue when she first met her in the coronation? And then she sees Cora here and she's like, you know, it's an honor to see you again. I was like, you know what? She got here for a reason. She's able to be like this terrifying dictator because she knows how to work people and she could really convince, you know, anyone to do anything if she really wanted to. So I'm impressed by Kuvira's character. I think it's a very well written out and fleshed out character from how little we see of her so far. Like, up to here, I feel so intrigued to see what she's going to do next.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite part of Kuvira is her political ness, which I'll go into soon. Caitlin, what's your favorite scene?
So mine was just from Varric doing his experiments with the spirit plants and the fact that he names a unit of measure after himself. Like, I love him.
And Karen, yours is related. What's your favorite scene?
Yeah, Julie kicking ass because she was so cool in those bot suits and just taking them down and being awesome, and then Varric kept getting in the way, as he usually does, but she's a very capable person, and it's too bad we don't see more of that.
And Karen, can I just say, it's a good thing that we told you newbies not to watch the trailer, because that little moment in the trailer where her mask comes up and you see her in those mech suits, and she looks kind of evil at first, and I think that would have given away way too much to say, like, why is she in a mech suit, you know what I mean? I remember that being like the big moment. That's almost like the Zuko moment for me from when I was watching season 3. trailer before it came out, or season four, two, three. Just don't watch the trailer yet, because there's still more that you don't want to be spoiled by.
Yeah, for sure. I'm lying. I have no idea. I don't remember what's in the trailers. well, my favorite scene were the flashbacks with Sue and Kavira, you know, like I said before, because I think you really can view those scenes from two different perspectives and really understand why everyone is acting the way they're acting, even if you don't approve of it, whichever side you disapprove of, or maybe you approve of all or disapprove of both. But I found that really, really fascinating. So Mitch, what was your favorite line?
Mine's when Varric's kind of freaking out and he's like having like this weird kind of hypochondriatic, is that a word? Panic attack. And then he's like, Julie, hold your breath. We're all going to die. She's like, I'm not holding my breath. And there's no sir. There's no thank you. It's just, she's just done with his shit.
That's basically Julie. Like, she is 1,000% done. Speaking of which, Caitlin.
So mine was after Julie betrays Varric and is like, she's just gone off about how much she can't stand him. And she goes, guards, do the thing. And Varric's like, no, not the thing. I just love how the thing is everything. And Varric knows the thing. That's what it is.
Yeah, I think those two definitely like communicate psychically on some level. And Karen, another Julie line.
Yeah,
I mean,
she
another
was
Varric line.
Just this whole situation was awesome this episode, but this kind of goes off of Caitlin's favorite scene after Varric names the measurement after himself and he goes, Julie, shut it down. There are too many Varics. And I'm like, oh, can you imagine more than one Varric in the world? It would just be too much.
I had that mental image and I shuddered.
Because he would clone himself. Like, no question.
Karen, as a newbie, I have to ask you, Natalie criticized me pointing out, like, what do you think Varric's doing with the spirit vines stuff? I don't know if you listened to the last episode, but I made it as a point in the doc. And she was like, that's Mitch not being subtle. I think that, I don't know, from my opinion, it was fairly, like, out there that this was going to be a development in the next couple episodes. Like, were you shocked that it came up in these episodes, the spirit vine stuff?
I don't know. I don't think I really, like, thought about it too much. It just seemed like a natural progression of the story, so I kind of just went with it.
Oh, okay. No, I was just wondering if I said too much there, because, you know, obviously we're seeing it develop, and I'm interested to see if you have any other opinions on it, Karen, as we go along, because it's fun to hear what newbies think about this.
So my favorite line was Kuvira saying to Korra, the world was descending into chaos while you were gone. In order to fix it, I had to make some tough decisions. Which, again, is such a, like, mind bleep for Korra. You know, just she's turning... Kuvira is standing there with an army, and she's turning the blame on Korra, you know, which is... And she knows that's exactly how to get to her. Like, you were not functioning as the Avatar. You know, you weren't doing your job because you were off being weak. And so I had to do what I had to do. Which immediately puts Korra on the defensive, and as, you know, as we've seen, she almost acts like she is in the wrong here. She's like, okay, we'll try and work it out, like, I'll talk to Sue, you know, she's not acting like someone who is in control of the situation, she's acting like someone who's being controlled, and I don't love that Korra is doing that, but I really think it's a fascinating dynamic. So, moving on to Chapter 6, The Battle of Zhao Fu. In this chapter, Sue tries to kill Kuvira because that is what disappointed foster parents do, apparently. And then Korra has to battle it out Avatar style, but she loses because even though she has an amazing new outlook and an amazing new haircut, she still has PTSD. Fortunately, the airbenders are still cool, like duh, like always, and they spirit her away on an air bison. The metal-bending city falls because the Earth Nation has no chill. Varric tries to blow himself up because he is heartbroken, but Bolin is finally done being a fuckboy and he saves everyone, sort of. Also, I want to add on to Ariana's recap. At the end of the episode, Kuvira is like, okay, great, awesome, I'm in charge of all this, and start dismantling the domes, which is a line that you should pay attention to, I'm just going to say.
I actually forgot that I was supposed to pay attention to it, not until you mentioned it, but until I thought about it, I was like, why does that sound significant? Oh, that's why.
Yeah. Yeah, let's just, yeah, leave that there. So Opal is in a really interesting position, and actually everyone is in a really interesting position in these episodes, which is why I'm really so into them. But Opal wants to
like, kick Kuvira's ass. And, you know, she's like, my family's being threatened, my home is being threatened. And Jinora's, I mean, Ariana is not wrong, and she compares the Air Nation to the Night's Watch. So she's like, you can't fight your personal battles here. And Opal's basically like, the hell I can't, but holds off for a little while. Basically, the bulk of this episode, I mean, after we have the aborted assassination attempt, which is pretty hardcore, we get to, you know, that event, basically, even though the Earth Kingdom, I'm sorry, even though Zaofu is vastly, is basically outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, and outplanned from Kuvira's army, Kuvira acts like the wounded party here and decides that she can just basically attack. So Korra's like, no. So basically Korra and Kuvira end up having a much anticipated showdown, which goes really, really poorly for Korra. Karen, how did you feel about this fight between Korra and Kuvira? It goes on for a long time and it is not at all, like, it's not an Avatar fight like we are used to seeing. It's Korra getting her ass handed to her repeatedly and being emotionally beaten down in the process.
Yeah, I was really surprised because I thought now that the poison's out of her, now that she's talked to Toph and Toph has kind of told her what direction she has to go in order to get better, that she would be much stronger than she is. And the fact that Kuvira stays so calm the entire time and just easily dodges all of her moves and just keeps hitting her one after the other was actually really hard to watch, because I was like, come on, Korra, I know you can do it. And in the end, she couldn't do it. She needed help. She needed saving. And I was really surprised by that. But considering where we are in the season, I think it makes sense that she still needs to build herself up a little bit. And I'm just proud of her for going out there and trying anyway, because obviously that was something that she was struggling with. And I think that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely, you know, even when Korra takes steps back, there are certain steps forward in terms of the realization of the problem. Caitlin, how did you feel about these fights? And specifically, I want to talk about the end when she sees what I call the Nega Korra. It's like, Nega. Does anyone know what Nega means? You probably know, Mitch, right?
From the evil world, like your evil twin-ish.
Yeah, basically. So it's, or sort of like, you know, herself in the bad Avatar state, completely out of control, but she sees Kuvira's face turn into, and that, you know, hits her and completely knocks her off guard. So Caitlin, how did you feel about kind of the battle culminating in that event?
Well, I appreciate that they're not just treating her PTSD like it needs to be cured when she gets the rest of the bits of metal out of her system, because the bits of metal weren't the actual issue she's facing. They were a symptom of the problem, but her problem is psychological. So I like that it continues to be something. And Korra was looking for a quick fix and realizes pretty quickly that's not actually what she got in getting the metal out of her system. So I think it was smart.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And Mitch, any thoughts on this pretty epic fight?
I love when Jinora wants to jump in and then Korra tells her not to, because they have such a strong relationship at this point. They've been through so much. Jinora's like her like secondhand avatar, basically. And it's great because Korra always has, you know, her main crew backing her up. And I feel like she has so much more help than Aang ever did. And it really is, it's nice just to see like that they don't really care. Like, if Korra's going to die, they're going to save her, period. They're going to break all the rules. They're going to start a war over saving her. And then that emotional moment when Korra tells Jinora to stay back, it gets me so down to my core. I love, 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 love that relationship coming through in this episode overall.
Yeah, they're definitely, well, first of all, I need to note that, like, this is like the big, kind of one of the big battles in the series, right? And all the people involved are women, which is like, yes, awesome. So I just had to note that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we could do, like, go through, like, six more warriors, and all of them would be women before we had to go to, like, the male bench, which is cool. Nothing against the guys. They're awesome. I'm just saying. You don't usually see that. It's interesting that, you know, Opal, obviously, I think everybody can kind of relate to what she's going through. But Opal and Jenora kind of serve as, like, not the angel and the devil, but sort of opposite sides of what Korra is thinking, right? So mm-hmm. she has, like, Opal, who's, like, understandably chomping at the bit to, like, fight. And you have Jenora, who is, like, the uber spiritual, you know, peacekeeping type of person. So it's very interesting that nobody else from, like, Team Korra is there. It's just the two of them. And you have Sue kind of unhelpfully shouting at her from the sideline. I really don't like Sue. I'm sorry if anybody does.
Like at all?
Yeah, I really don't like her. I think she's extremely manipulative and selfish and whatever.
And you're a fan of Kuvira.
Yeah, I am, because Kuvira at least is not like a liar about it. Kuvira's like, I'm a manipulative bitch, you know? Where Sian's like, no, I'm not, like, this is for your own good. I mean, Kuvira does that too, let's face it. I'm not saying that there's, like, 100%, like, logicality here, but let's just say that I appreciate it more in Kuvira, who is trying to protect the Earth Kingdom, as opposed to Sian, who's basically just, who has good goals too, because she's trying to keep her family together, and I totally understand that, but she is also just trying to keep her life in Zaofu at stasis in the way she wants and the way she's set up. And and by the way, the comparisons between Kuvira and Sian are really interesting and valid, and I think there's a lot to talk about there. I don't know if this is the right place. Do you guys want to go into that? Or
I can't think of a better opportunity as a super fan to think about it later on. And I also have to say that, too, I really love both voice actors, so it makes it hard to not like both Kuvira and Sue. I think that they have such commanding voices, and they sell these roles so well. I love that Zelda Williams is so invested in this, too, because you could feel it in her performance as Kuvira. It is, she blows me out of the water as this character. It's, it makes me so happy.
Yeah, I definitely love Zelda Williams in the role. And I think, I mean, so I guess in the parallels, I like I said before, I think that they're both people who have very strong ideas of the world and, you know, have the opportunity to pursue that. You know, obviously a lot of that is because Kuvira was raised by Suyin, but, you know, they share similar downsides, which is, you know, a kind of unyieldingness, unwillingness to cooperate, to, I don't know, you know, they both kind of put themselves into positions where and land Korra in a position where it's very hard to come up with a decent negotiation, because I understand why Suyin doesn't want Zhaofu to be under the Earth Kingdom's control, under Kuvira's control, but I understand why Kuvira's like, no, dude, you're part of the Earth Kingdom, you're an Earth Kingdom city, like, you have to be part of this nation, even though, again, they're both kind of, they have other motivations for that as well. Yeah, any other thoughts on Suyin and Kuvira?
Well, I see a big parallel with Opal too, in this, like, not really knowing where to go from here. And I really felt for Opal in this episode because she wants to fight, clearly. Like, she wants her mom back. She wants to get her brothers back. But then you have Jenora sitting there being like, it's only going to make things worse. And Korra being caught in the middle and not knowing what to do. And I think it was a really hard decision. And I see Sue and Kuvira as sort of being opposite sides of the same coin. Like, they could have both gone in the other person's direction, but they chose, you know, where they are and what steps they were going to take, and they ended up going in opposite directions. And the fact that they can be so similar is really interesting, like you were saying. None of this, like, this entire situation is not black and white, I don't think, because I can see where people are being like, well, this is how we believe it's going to help the Earth Kingdom, and other people being like, are you crazy? Like, you know, this is a dictatorship now. It's something completely different. And so I can see everybody's point of view, and it made it really hard to watch Korra struggle with all of that, because you could see her understanding where Kuvira is coming from, understanding where Sue is coming from. The same thing with Jenora and Opal, and the fact that she decided to do anything, I think, is amazing, because I was like, I don't really know what I would do in that situation.
Yeah,
you know what the hardest part about this is, too? It's when I start to compare it to, and I'm not looking for some prequel hate here, but Obi-Wan versus Anakin, where it's kind of like you were raised by them and you want to kill them because you've become more powerful than them and you're turning to the dark side almost. And I think it's always been a heartbreaking story for me, and to see it played out with characters that I think I'm even more invested in than the prequel characters makes me really, it just really hurts, because I wish everyone could just get along and, you know, eat cupcakes and paint rainbows. But I just think that Kuvira is too powerful for her own good. This power has to go somewhere. She has to do something with it, because if she just sits back and she's Sue's puppy for the rest of her life, she's never going to be happy.
Which is Batara's problem as well, actually. We definitely get that. I mean, we kind of got it, but we definitely get it spelled out in this episode that he does not want to be in his family's shadow anymore. He's sick of being a Beifong just for Beifong's sake and wants to be his own man. Unfortunately, he's kind of a wuss, so. But speaking of cupcakes,
newbie prediction. How's this wedding going to go? Batara Jr. and Kuvira. Is this going to be a lovely wedding, Karen?
Oh, God. I mean, clearly she's manipulating him so much. We particularly saw that here. And it's just, I don't know. Like, I didn't even remember this dude before now. And now he's like all up in my face and I just don't care. And Kuvira is just doing whatever she wants with him, and he's just going along with it. And I mean, I feel bad for him, and I guess I can understand, considering I didn't remember him kind of being in his family's shadow, but I don't know. Poor guy. I don't think it's going to end well for him.
Well, like, where do you think they go next? Like, what's his goal anymore? Is he still, like, is he all for Kuvira, or is he swayed by his mom's, you know, refusal to give up Zhao Fu? Or, like, do you think he's going to feel any remorse, or is he, like, he's totally gung-ho on the fact that he's like, oh yeah, all Kuvira, all the time?
I think he definitely has, like, Kuvira blinders on. I don't know if right now he feels any sort of, like, sway from his mother, but I guess I could kind of see him as being like Percy Weasley, where maybe in the end, you know, he's going to be like, oh, crap, I did a bad thing, and now I need to try and fix it. Which would actually be really nice. I would really enjoy that storyline.
That's funny. I was going to bring up Percy Weasley, and I thought that because I'm a super fan, I can't speculate, you know? So it doesn't help, so I'm glad you brought it up. Because he's such a Percy right now, isn't he? Like, his family's like, we're so disappointed in you, but we still love you.
Yeah, basically.
It kind of breaks your heart. See? The Beifongs get to you, I'm telling you.
Well, he's definitely a Percy, that's for sure. How, if he continues to be Percy or another member, we'll figure out. anyway, so another major plot line of this episode was kind of a lot of drama going down on the Kuvira train, where Varric basically decides to blow everything up because he has lost his will to live and decides that, I don't know. He's just basically like, nothing's worth anything. Julie left me. I'm a prisoner. And he's very dramatic about it. But it makes a really compelling scene, in my opinion, where Varric basically decides to, as I said, blow everything up and presents that fact in a really fascinating way to Batara and everybody else. And you have Valin, meanwhile, kind of going like, wait a second. I want to get out of here, but I don't want to do it as a corpse. So, how do we work this out? Caitlin, how did you feel about this? In my opinion, this is definitely Varric's, like, shining moment.
That's sort of a sad statement. That's a shining moment. I mean, I was sort of, like, with Bolin, like, I thought he was faking it. Like, he made a bomb, quote-unquote, and then was going to get them off with the threat and then be like, ah, sucker. But then he actually was going through with that. It was like, you crazy! Like, he's smart enough that he should have been able to make a fake and then blow it up after they got off, but No, he was just crazy. He's just crazy.
I think he thinks out of order, too, which is something that is referenced in somebody's quote. And I think your quote, actually, Caitlin. Yeah, Varric doesn't think in straight lines, that's for sure.
And he's only useful for, like, 15 minutes in the afternoon, and it wasn't his useful time of the day.
Right. But I think what appeals to me about this is that it's kind of the first time we've seen Varric acting with conviction, you know, and it's the first time that we really get that maybe he does have a stake in this, you know, even if he doesn't want to, he's kind of coming to realize that he can either, like, do something good or really allow evil to triumph here. Especially since he is kind of the mechanist of a lot of the extreme evil. I mean, we see what that spirit vine bomb can do. It's kind of insane. So Karen, how did you feel about this kind of maybe unexpected, but also maybe kind of coming for a while, Varric's turn / attempted suicide?
Yeah. It is funny that, you know, him turning around is attempted suicide, but all jokes aside, like, this is the first time that we've seen him be selfless, and I think that was a huge moment for him, and maybe he could have done something a little more productive and less dangerous for himself and Bolin, especially without consulting Bolin, but I think that it is huge that he was like, you know what, I'm going to destroy this thing, even though it could potentially make me tons of money, because that's the right thing to do. And I'm just glad that Bolin was there to be like, we should probably escape now.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that was totally selfless with the way he's like, we'll be part of a story. He varicked her because she's you lead him. And I'm like, I'm not convinced it was totally altruistic. He wanted the infamy too.
Yeah, but you can't enjoy infamy when you're dead.
See, I think he's crazy enough that he just knows, like, knowing that it will come is enough.
Yeah, I mean, I could see both sides, honestly. I think there was some selflessness in there, I think that,
I don't think it's solely selfless. I think there was a little bit of selfishness in there. But I don't disagree that he was doing something unselfish by destroying it, but I don't think it was completely altruistic.
And what count did this bring the attempted suicide / successful suicides of Korra up to? Like, 5? it's a lengthy list.
Well, we have, obviously...
Kazan.
What's his face? Oh, right, Kazan. In the first season, Amon and Tarlok. I guess it's really just Tarlok, but whatever.
Ish.
Korra
almost jumps off the cliff-ish?
I don't really count that, because I don't think that was an actual attempt. I think it was a thought. I might count during the, when she's trying to prevent herself from going into the Avatar state, but that's my personal theory.
This is a Nickelodeon show that is not a Nickelodeon show, and I know we've made that point a lot, but it's amazing to me that this came out of Atla. Like, this feels like its own different beast. Could you ever imagine these themes being an Atla? We thought Atla was extreme with, like, you know, is Jet really dead or whatever, but then we really get into this where, like, we learn about characters psychologically and we learn about how they want to take their lives because they're prisoners of war or because they lost in the battle or something. You never would have seen that in Atla. Like, Azula never would have committed suicide fighting against Aang if she lost in that season 2 finale. I think that she would have been a prisoner and escaped or something. It just seems like the whole dial of, like human despair has been turned up past level 10 for Legend of Korra sometimes.
Well, the audience grew up, so the show grew up.
Yeah, and that's definitely shown by this fact that this is such a lighthearted thing almost, where it's like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna kill myself with this giant bomb, whatever, I'll be remembered with history. And that's just, like, so nonchalant to the point where it's like, we should probably be more disturbed about this, not just like, oh cool, he wants to kill himself, well, this, it'll be funny the way it goes down. Like, I know we're not saying that ourselves, but it's presented, I think, a little bit more comically than it's meant to be interpreted.
Yeah, could be. So those are definitely kind of the major plots of this episode. We also have, we do have the escape where art lessons are interrupted, which are pretty hilarious because Milo is
an excellent visual artist, but maybe not channeling his inner artist as much. Even though I would argue with what's-his-face that with the artist's son that that Ron. Is actually how Milo sees himself inside. So,
how long do you think it took for them to like render that image of Milo, like create that?
I don't know. So, they're all really good artists. They could probably do that pretty fast.
Yeah, that would take me my whole life to even try and accomplish. And there's Milo in like one afternoon.
Yeah, and we also have, you know, Bolin and Varric do escape. They're kind of, you know, not in a great place right now, but they are presumed dead by Kuvira, which is possibly a bonus. Even though I'm kind of like, you know, Batara's like, oh yeah, they're absolutely dead. And I'm like, dude, do your research. I mean, come on. Crying out loud.
Like, unless Bolin closed that hole behind him that he jumped down into. And by the way, how did he survive that? Like, I don't understand. Did he make a nice pillowy mound of like rubble really quickly, or like what happened there? I still don't understand.
I would assume he did something to like make a slide or something to make it somewhat less painful.
That definitely didn't feel too good. We can admit that much.
Well, at least they didn't blow up. So yeah. I would take falling out of a train over blowing up any day.
Yeah. But I guess one last thing I want to just touch on is kind of the surrender or the involuntary surrender of Jakku after Korra runs away. Oh, and we have a very touching scene where, you know, obviously Opal wants to stay with her family, but, you know, Korra and Jinora hold her back and Suyin tells her to go. She says that she'll be back for them, which I found very moving. And yeah, so basically they're like, okay, so Jakku belongs to Kuvira now and everybody bow. But Batar and I can't, what's the guy's name? What's the artist's son's name?
Juan.
H-U-A-N, so Huan or Juan?
Oh, Huan. Oh, okay, fine. They both refuse to bow, and Batar has a conniption because this is basically all he's ever wanted from his life, is to get his father on his knees and, you know, kind of asserting
full stop. No, okay, continue, sorry.
asserting his superiority over his father, and that is not what he gets. So basically the only person who's really happy at the end of this episode is Kuvira, which I think is orchestrated. It's meant to be that way. How does everyone else feel about this at the end of the episode?
I was honestly a little surprised that they actually got the city. I thought that it was going to, first of all, be harder than that, but also I thought that there would be a standoff or something. I was surprised that it was taken so quickly because it feels like such an important move in this chess game to get the city and to get Sue, maybe not under control because it's not like they've managed to get her to agree to the terms, but they have her captured. I mean, she's not going anywhere anytime soon. So I think it's really interesting that they did this quickly, but I also think that just goes to show Kuvira's strength and how much strategy she puts into all of her moves. And it makes her a little bit scarier than she already has been, which is saying something.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I think every episode, Kuvira's notoriety and kind of what the length she's willing to go definitely increase episode by episode. Any last thoughts before we end off?
So I think we're all in agreement that, like, Korra was ready to kill Kuvira with that giant rock smash, and Kuvira was ready to kill Korra with those metal blades. Like, that was it. Like, one of them was going to die right then and there if the airbenders didn't intervene.
Yeah. I mean, it was basically the 10 dual commandments.
See, you know, I wonder if the Avatar state wouldn't have kicked in, though, again, because of the fact that it was kicking in with the poison and all that. Like, I feel like still Korra would like breathe fire and like melt Kuvira to a metal puddle at that point. Like, that wouldn't have been the end of Korra. I feel like there would have been more fight left in her because she would have been able to get over herself the fact that she saw blades coming at her face.
No, I disagree, because then the Avatar would just be the Hulk. Like, you can kill the Avatar.
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't think, like,
yes, you can.
Being in mortal danger does trigger the Avatar state, but it's not every single kind of mortal danger. So.
She was also unconscious. So yeah. She wasn't aware that she had metal blades coming at her.
Uh-huh. Well, we had Deus Ex Genora to come in there and save the day regardless, so we're good.
At least they were in the area.
Like, yeah, at least she was actually like there this time.
Yeah, although it should really be coming down as the floating virgin
there to rebirth the new light spirit or whatever that was.
Okay.
She did she did conveniently transport herself real quick to go get Milo and whatnot. So
yeah, I know. I'm trying to pretend that didn't happen.
Yeah, I know. It just feels like that should have been better written, like more planned out, so that she wouldn't have to do that. Like, have someone else on watch or something? I don't know. Like, it's a big world battle. Don't just be like, okay, we have three people, period.
Yeah, it's also just annoying that she can communicate at any time with anyone. It's like, yeah.
There's no limit to it, though. Like, yeah.
It's like she has a cell phone or something. Yeah, oh, exactly. My God.
And nobody else has a cell phone except when they're trying to, when she's trying to contact them. Then they automatically have a cell phone. But anyway.
Cue Lady Gaga's telephone. All you want, but there's nobody home, so I'm not going to answer my cell phone, telephone, whatever it is. That's everyone else to Genora. Okay, I'll stop.
Well, what was your favorite scene, Mitch?
Okay, mine's when Kor hallucinates that Kuvira is her. I love the way it's animated, and I love the way that Kuvira's hair comes out so that it covers her face enough so that when she like looks up, you're like, oh, like, is Kuvira going to be like all bloody and beaten up? And then it's just Kor's face. And you're like, oh, it's back. Negacore is back.
Oh, I have to say, for a split second, I thought, this is really dumb, so don't laugh at me. I thought that Kuvira was going to be like another avatar, right?
No, Karen.
And her eyes. And I was like, oh my God, what is happening right now? But then obviously it was Korra. So I got very confused, but that was my split second reaction.
I hear that. Yeah, it's definitely a scene that's meant to interview. I don't think we're immediately meant to go to like the logical explanation. Yeah.
I was totally on. I was like, okay, hallucination, like the second that I saw it. Like, not this time around, obviously, but you know, like when I originally saw it, I was like, this is just whatever. But I can get why you think she would be the avatar. Like, we always want another avatar. Imagine if it came out of Kuvira.
Oh my God. It was just so dramatic how they like, her hair was all covering her, and then she looked up so slowly, and yeah.
Imagine that Avatar versus Avatar fight. Like, wouldn't that have just been, whew.
We sort of had that. It wasn't that exciting.
Yeah, you're right. Unabatsu battle was just like, yeah, I don't know, giant Godzilla fight. Do you guys find yourself disappointed when water isn't used in Avatar battles? Because I find that it's like the unused element that should be. Because Kor uses it once against Zaheer when she freezes his foot, and it's so effective. And I was like, okay, keep on freezing him then. And in this battle, Kor doesn't find water, I guess, because she's kind of in a deserty area, but I feel like the Avatar spirit would still find some. Like, doesn't Aang conveniently get some when he's battling Ozai, he just to make that sphere? I feel like the environment has enough that they can still suck it out with their super bending powers when they're in the Avatar state.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been like significant enough. And I also think that this has been a thread through Kor that she actually doesn't, I mean, she tends to use fire and earth much more than she uses the other elements.
Yeah, but I mean, air gave those two elements run for its money in this battle. She started punching a lot with air, and I was really happy. I love when she does it, because I just think
even though that's not really how you're supposed to use airbending, but
yeah. No, it's not. But I just think back to how she first used it when she used it against Amon, how far she's come, and especially Genora and Iki, Genora and Opal, how they're so much more of a master at their element too in this battle. It's very impressive. I love the hurricane that they create.
Yeah, that's definitely cool. Even the mechas have trouble getting through that.
Mm-hmm.
Caitlin, what was your favorite scene?
So mine was Iki and Milo painting, because it was hilarious.
Like the only light moment episode.
I love how Huan was like looking at Iki's bright doodles and was like, it hurts me. Like, it hurts my eyes. I was like, you like that.
Yeah, I really like that guy. Karen, you basically have the same one.
Yeah, it was more of a thread throughout of Milo just being this awesome artist, because when he drew that portrait of Kor, like, I was totally expecting some Sokka level, like, terrible portrait, and then it was so realistic, and then he comes around and he has his own thing, and then Hyun just not being impressed by it. It was really funny.
Yeah, definitely, definitely a highlight. My favorite scene was, you know, Varric kind of getting everyone else off the train with the threat of this bomb, because, I don't know, there's something in his voice that has not been there before, and I just found it really, really powerful and compelling. And yeah, we kind of discussed why that was so interesting, but that was definitely my favorite part. Mitch, what was your favorite line?
My favorite line was Batar Jr.'s, "That man was crazier than a sewer pipe elephant rat. Eyes bug out." The look on his face is priceless. I wish I could just... I wish that was like that Patrick meme from SpongeBob, you know, when his mouth is agape. I want Batar Jr. to be the next Patrick.
I like when they were calling each other names, him and Varric. Four.
Yeah, you shouldn't try and, like, out-immature Varric, because that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And I know what you're talking about, what's in his voice, because he goes, like, "Trust me, kid, I got this." And it's so serious. Yeah, there's something going on with that voice actor.
Like, "You're staying, you're going." I was like, whoa, Varric, oh my goodness.
I know, like, that voice actor gets it. He knows when to turn off the silly Varric and when to turn on the serious business Varric.
Yeah. Caitlin, what was your favorite line?
So mine was Varric explaining that he's going to blow the train up. And
thank you for this, Caitlin. Thank you.
It has a timer, but it also has a remote. It's like, Batar Jr.'s like, "Why do you have a timer and a remote?" So Varric has to explain, "Well, first I built the timer, but then I thought you could drive me off the train. So then I built a remote, but then I thought, well, now do I really need a timer anymore? Because I got a remote in my..." Whatever, I'm covering all my bases. Like,
genius writing.
Karen, how about you?
Mine comes right before the battle with Kuvira when Korra says, "It's been a while, but I've got a lot of pent-up rage." It was nice to hear a little of the old Korra in there. I don't hate how she's trying to be more thoughtful, because I think that's something that she's struggled with in the past, just kind of jumping into all of the fights. But then when she needs to get down to it, she's willing to get in there and get dirty and to fight. And I just like, she's like, "Yeah, I need to blow off some steam. I might as well do it punching Kuvira."
Yeah. Yeah, I like that one too. And my favorite line, I'm going to explain this one, but it's, "Didn't you hear he Varric'd himself? Because some girls you lead him," which is Varric, obviously, talking about killing himself. And Yuli, you know, going, whatever, leaving him or betraying him or whatever. But I saw a weird parallel to Shakespeare in that, which is, there's a play called Troilus and Cressida, and there is a lot of speeches between Troilus, who's the male hero, and Cressida, who is the female hero, except that she sort of betrays Troilus. She sort of doesn't really. She's basically kidnapped, but it's Shakespeare, so it's all the woman's fault. And they have these speeches when they're getting together initially that basically it's as true as Troilus, like, if people, he's saying how dedicated he's going to be to her. And as he says, "As true as Troilus shall crown up the verse." And then she says, "If she is false to him," she says, "Yea, live and stick to the heart of falsehood as false as Cressid." And that obviously has, like, ironic connotations later in the play, but I kind of found an echo there. It's probably not intentional, but I saw it anyway. So, anyway, back to normal rewatchable business. If you would like to contact us, once again, you can reach us by email at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can talk to us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave comments on this post on hypeable.com, of which we had many last week, but we're going to talk about that in a second. You can play with us on Tumblr, and you can leave us an iTunes review. If you rate us 5 stars, Karen will draw you an... 2 portraits of you, one of which shows your outer visage and one of which shows your true inner spirit.
Ooh, Karen's going back to her artistic roots. I like it. Didn't we have any painting things from, like, the past from Atla, I think?
I don't have artistic roots. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think, well, we talked about you being in a busty bikini on top of a flaming volleyball net at one point. That's pretty artistic. That's, you know, very acrobatic. So maybe this relates.
Performance art?
This is way better than that. Okay. but anyway, moving on to... our comments. We had a lot of comments last week about kind of debating Korra as the Avatar. I know some of the people from the other podcasts aren't so keen on Korra as the Avatar and as a character, but I don't think any of us really feel that way. I know I don't. Anyone?
I mean, I'm a big fan of Korra in this season. I don't really have too much hate left. I think it's all gone away after season two ended.
Yeah. So we're basically going to just like put a pause on that. And if the other guys would like to respond, because I don't think there's really any point in us responding, because then we're just like, yes, I agree. I like Korra. Cool. Then we'll decide if that comes back into the conversation. But there was one question that I wanted to discuss, which is that Vegemiter said on Hypable, do you think that Korra would have been a better Avatar if she'd lived during the Atla era? It seems like some of the personality traits that make her a poor Avatar in this series would have been assets in wartime. Aang struggled because he had a tendency to run away from conflicts and responsibilities. Remember when he was like, yeah, I'm going to wait to attack after Ozai has destroyed the Earth Kingdom to attack him. Yeah. Korra has the opposite problem. She wouldn't have had any qualms about killing an evil mass murdering dictator. Thoughts?
I mean, I think it really depends. I think that's a great point, not something that I had thought of before, and I think her wanting to jump into the fight would be an asset. However, I think that whenever you deal with extremes, it's always better to kind of come toward the middle. And even if Korra still was leaning toward being more of a fighter than running away, you know, I definitely think that would be a benefit. But I think she still would have had to have learned some of the same lessons, which would be to stop, to pause, to kind of figure out the lay of the land and maybe not jump into the fight all the time.
Right. Like, Aang might not have been the best Avatar for wartime, but he was the perfect Avatar to rebuild after the Hundred Year War. And Korra, I don't think, would have had those skills. So I tend to think this goes more along the lines of, like, it's not the Avatar you deserve, it's not the Avatar you need. What's the Batman line? Not the one you need, it's the one you deserve.
Not the Avatar we need, but the one we deserve?
Yeah, I think so. So it's basically like, no Avatar is perfectly suited for their time period. I don't think any leader is truly perfectly suited for their time period. It is, you know, it's a combination of suitability and circumstance. And, you know, those things have to kind of work themselves out. Caitlin, any thoughts?
I think Aang was suited for wartime, because if you're going to come at violence, coming at it from the other side of peace and mercy is the ideal way to bring about a new era. Like, if you have Korra, when she starts, who is very volatile, you have violence and volatility against violence and volatility, and that's only going to escalate problems, and it probably would have made things even worse by the end. But Aang's mercifulness, I think, was what was needed to resolve everything.
That's a good point. And I mean, I guess by that note, you could say that Korra's proactiveness is kind of important. Like, if she'd been a weaker-willed Avatar, like, because everyone is kind of questioning, like, what's the role of the Avatar now in modern times, right? So if she'd been a weaker-willed Avatar, maybe she wouldn't, like, maybe the Avatar position would have been, like, significantly reduced, but because of her strength, it's not.
I remember there was someone that emailed in a bit ago, and we talked about it on the Rewatchable episode. I can't remember what we were covering, but it related because it was talking about how, like, Korra was gone for a long time and no one really needed to care because Aang was gone for 100 years and the world just got on just fine. So I'm wondering still if the world really does need an Avatar. Like, does Toth have a point here?
How did it get on just fine?
Remember the Hundred Year War thing?
Took over.
Huh?
The world did not get along just fine without Aang. It might have kept on spinning, but the Fire Nation completely took over and enslaved a whole bunch of the world.
I just like to think in my head canon that Zuko eventually would have come to his senses and just killed his father anyway, so I've been happy with that.
He wouldn't have.
The Legend of Not Aang.
Yeah, I gotta disagree with you there. I think the world definitely does need an Avatar. I think that it is definitely different from what the, you know, it changes from generation to generation. I think that maybe every generation honestly kind of thinks like, well, we don't really need the Avatar anymore, but they ultimately find ways that they do. And
well, the reason I'm thinking about this is like, okay, maybe we do need an Avatar, but just not as frequent. We don't need them for 24/7 surveillance for the 150 years they're going to live or whatever it is. And the reason I'm saying that, too, is also because there was a guy who said, Avatar, we still have one of those, to Korra. And that makes me think that basically it's kind of like, I don't know, I guess this is a bad example, but it's the only thing I can think of, like the UN. Like, they come in when they need to, and they only need to be involved when, like, the shit really hits the fan. But other than that, they don't need to be involved in, like, menial little things. I mean, unfortunately for...
Great track record.
Well, I mean, for Korra, it kind of sucks because... you know, she had four dictators come after her specifically, so she really didn't have a choice but get involved. But Aang came along to destroy the one and only dictator, as far as we know. I mean, he kind of had Yukon, the blowblender that raised Amon / Noatak and Tarlok. But other than that, I think Aang just had Ozai, as far as Korra history seems to tell us. So, well, I mean, yeah, would it help just to have them drop in every once in a while and be like, I'm here to kill the bad guy. Okay, I'm gone.
But he had a very active role in politics. I mean, he founded Republic City. He and, you know, I mean, that's the reason the comics are continuing, right? Because it wasn't just like, oh, okay, happily ever after. Everybody's gone. It's cool. The point is, I mean, it's like, it's almost like the Jedi, right? Like, you, like, not every single star system in Star Wars has been positively affected by the Jedi, but the ones that were needed them. And there are always going to be people who need that. I think that each generation needs to figure out how that fits in for them. And it's not going to be the same every time, because that's what happens with time and progress. But I think that it's definitely, I mean, in our modern times, I could see us needing an Avatar, you know, for sure. Like, in our lives. So
wouldn't it have been interesting, though, to see Amon become a larger villain, more than just Republic City, but someone who was able to take over a lot more? I don't know that they needed an Avatar to destroy him, but I think that, and it's funny, too, because then Unalaq only came because there was an Avatar. Like, you know, he needed someone to open up those portals. So if Korra just dodged him for a while, I'm sure that would have gone decently well for a while. And then on to season three, they're trying to kill her. They're coming after her specifically and after world leaders. I don't know. It's all kind of weird. I still haven't decided whether or not we need an Avatar. I know that everyone else on this podcast seems to be really convinced that we do, but I'm not 100% on the fact that we need one all the time, just sometimes.
I mean, if you're comfortable with bad guys being around, that's cool. Anyway, moving on. Caitlin, you want to take True Green?
Sure. We got a tweet from TrueGreen7 who says, I gotta say, listening to you guys talk about Avatar and Korra really gets me through my grueling college work. Thank you. You're welcome, and good luck on your studies.
Yes, very much. College. Karen, you want to take Zach H. Official?
Yes. Zach H. Official says, a future purchase at Rewatchable. I have no idea what this is in reference to.
Here, scroll down.
Don't worry, just scroll. You'll figure it out.
Oh, scrolling. Oh, that's cool. It's, is it a vinyl sticker?
Yeah,
it's like one of those.
For a computer.
Have you ever had one of those, Karen, for your computer?
No, but I've seen them before. So it's just a vinyl sticker of, like, Avatar State Korra. That looks nice. I like that.
But, like, and her eyes are on the apple, so they're glowing.
Yeah.
Right.
I love some pretty cool clever things like that. That's awesome.
Yeah. I had, like, a Pikachu one once where his, like, cheeks lit up on it. It was really cool.
Aw.
I know.
I had a really pretty design, but then the woman stopped making them, so I don't have it anymore. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Rewatchable. We'll be back next week with episodes 7 and 8. Stuff's getting even crazier. But anyway, so thank you so much for listening to us. We'll be back next week for their episodes. Please leave us your thoughts. I'm Michal.
I'm Mitchell.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Karen.
Flamio Hotman.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.